You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk with WPR news guy Noah Ovshinsky about the top state news stories of the week.
First, we take a look at fraternities and modern frat life. You might think of the parties, the socializing, and the networking, but our next guest says there's a dark side to fraternities. She spent the last year investigating the world of frats, including a look at some of the tragic events that happen at these houses.
Our guest says it can be hard to hold fraternities accountable because many have actually become more powerful than the colleges and universities that house them.
Joining us now is Caitlin Flanagan, contributing editor to The Atlantic. Her piece, The Dark Power of Fraternities, is this month's cover story, and we've got a link to that piece on the Central Time Facebook page. Caitlin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you spent the last year looking into the world of social fraternities, and I want to start by reading something you wrote. You wrote, "When there's a common denominator among hundreds of such injuries and deaths, one that exists across all kinds of campuses, from private to public, prestigious to obscure, then it is more than newsworthy. It begins to approach a national scandal." So, how big a national issue are the deaths and injuries of fraternities?
Well, when you think about the context in which they occur, which is college life, which shouldn't be by its very nature a very dangerous thing, if we were talking about young people who were in emergency services or who were in the military or something like that, we would certainly expect that there would be a great amount of consequent injury and even death. But this is very different. This is mothers and fathers who have saved money for many years, kids taking huge loans, going off to this kind of ennobling experience of education. And to see so many of these kids ending up dead, since 2006, some 60 kids have died in fraternity-related incidents, which is a tiny fraction of the number who have been seriously injured or sexually assaulted or otherwise harmed by it, then it becomes a very shocking kind of situation and something that's so old and that we've all gotten so used to that we tend not to think of it as a national scandal, but I think people from outside of our country are certainly shocked by it, and I think we ought to give it a second thought as well.
What kind of patterns did you see as you looked at the assaults, the deaths, the hazings that are happening at fraternities?
I spent a lot of time looking at the internal documents that are produced by the fraternity industry, particularly regarding their liability when these incidents happened. And what one thing I was certain of, incorrectly, was that the most common kind of injury would be from hazing, because that's what we always hear about. That's the great danger when you join a frat, that your brothers will haze you. In fact, hazing is the least common kind of reported injury at a fraternity. Number one is assault and battery. Kids get liquored up and they fight. There's a kid who was entered into a coma last week. He's still in a coma in Pennsylvania. Some boys, young men, were fighting at his frat. He broke up the fight. He got roundhouse punched, hit the ground hard on his head, and he's now in a coma. So that's the number one form of reported injury. Number two is sexual assault. The number two kind of insurance claim made against American fraternities is sexual assault of young women by men either belonging to the fraternity or guests of the fraternity, and that's some 15% of all injuries. So that's a significant number in itself. So I was sort of surprised by the variety and kinds of crime that, or rather of incidents, some of them criminal, that are far more prevalent than the hazing.
Now, I think when we think of the incidences you talk about, we assume, true or false, that it's probably got alcohol involvement somewhere at its root. How true is that when we assume that about fraternities and all the incidences you're talking about?
It's very, I looked at hundreds of incidents in the course of writing this essay, and alcohol, extreme alcohol use, was at the center, really, of every single one. What happened, as you remember, in the mid-80s, the uniform drinking age in all 50 states went up to age 21. It had been lowered at the time of Vietnam. Many states were 18 or 19. The idea was if you're old enough to fight in that war, you're old enough to get to buy a beer. And then in the mid-80s, peacetime, the drinking age changed. And what that did was it really changed the nature of drinking on campus, that it pushed all drinking off campus. It pushed a huge amount of drinking out of bars, where at least there's some monitoring of, if not of IDs, then of the amount that you drink. It pushed it off campus, and to an incredible extent, it pushed it into the fraternity houses, which have formal systems for the service of alcohol. So when you look at if there were a Venn diagram of the extreme binge drinking problem in colleges of America and the fraternity drinking problem, there's a pretty big overlap. Not all collegiate binge drinking by any stretch of the imagination is taking place in fraternities, but a large amount of it is, and a huge amount of consequent accidents and trauma occurs as a result.
Now, the fraternities themselves, as you paint them in your piece, seem incredibly well protected from litigation. They have systems in place for minimizing any sort of damage to the fraternities themselves and any sort of action that could be taken at a broad level. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about some of those systems and how they work?
Well, what happens when you join a fraternity, the most expensive part of your membership dues are for the fraternity insurance. They're not broken out as a separate line item, but they do explain that chapter by chapter the insurance is more or less depending on previous incidents over the last few years. So mom and dad back home might be a little anxious about this fraternity membership knowing that there are so many fraternity-related lawsuits, but they think to themselves, well, we have paid all this money for the fraternity insurance, so if he does become a named defendant in a lawsuit, that will pay out his claim. In fact, the fraternities use the insurance in a different way. That insurance that the young man paid for, in effect, it protects the national fraternity from the individual actions of the members. So that if a member is at the fraternity house one night and something terrible happens, upstairs a kid drinks himself to death, or a young woman is assaulted, or there's a dangerous event that happens, if that family's son was at the fraternity house breaking any rule at all, having one beer under the age of 21, for example, breaking any risk management policy, he can be instantly dropped from that fraternity insurance. It's not going to protect him. It's going to protect the national. Now, who's going to pay the claims against him? And I think this may be the most shocking part of my investigation for parents. The claims against that individual 18, 19, 20-year-old member get paid out of his parents' homeowners insurance. And beyond that, if that individual member needs a legal defense, because there are no public defenders in civil litigation, mom and dad pay for that as well.
And you write at one point in your piece that if a young man is involved in an incident where the fraternity sort of gets shut down, they're waiting for the national people from the organization to step in, you think the best thing for them to do is get out of the house and call their own lawyer.
Yeah, what happens is the kids are told, look, if a serious incident happens, be totally, I mean, the good news is they're told to be completely honest with the emergency personnel, completely honest with the cops, to call all the other members back to the house to get rid of all the guests and to immediately call the national hotline for the fraternity, and that indeed someone from the national office, if it's a serious incident, will be flying out to talk to them. And these young men assume incorrectly, and if they read the paperwork more carefully, they'd understand it, but they're many times young and they don't get it, they assume this guy from the National is going to come and help us. And he gives them lots of questionnaires, and they fill them out explaining exactly what happened and where they were, thinking, ah, good, here's this organization that I've pledged fealty to. They're here to help me. Not at all. All those questionnaires and all that investigating that happens in the chapter in the immediate hours afterwards will probably be used against the individual members by the national fraternity and can leave them hanging out to dry. So I would absolutely recommend if a young man is a member of a fraternity, if something goes wrong that night, don't sit around and wait for the folks from national to come. I would say go back to your dorm room, call your parents, tell them what's happened, and investigate the possibility of getting your own lawyer, because the fraternity's not on your side in that situation.
And what the fraternities themselves seem to be saying about all this is that it's a few bad eggs giving fraternities a bad name, that these are extreme situations, and in fact, lots of parents want their sons to be in fraternities because there are job connections, because they think fraternities foster civic engagement and growing men who will be responsible and contributing to society. What do you think about the bad egg argument?
Well, when fraternity is done right, it is a tremendous advantage to a young man. It really, in these tough economic times, that fraternity membership can supercharge a degree. You might be going to some, you know, somewhat regional institution in a part of the country that doesn't have a lot of connections to, say, investment banking or national politics or big-time law firms. But now you've joined a club for a relatively small amount of money that gives you an instant network to a huge, vast array of people all over the country and very largely represented in the fraternity powerhouse fields of business, politics, and law. And moreover, there's tremendous service opportunities. And again, when fraternity is done right, the opportunities for leadership are probably unequaled, because those young men are running their chapter. They probably have a budget of $500,000 a year. There isn't some grown-up supervisor telling them how to do it. They have to make the budget work. They have to make risk management policies line up. And so fraternity men tend to graduate with really exceptional abilities in terms of leadership and management that, again, they bought for pennies on the dollar, in a sense, for compared to having gone to get an MBA or some other degree that explicitly teaches you that kind of leadership.
We're talking right now with Caitlin Flanagan about her piece, The Dark Side of Fraternities.
You can join the conversation. Are you in a fraternity, or have you been in one in the past? What do you make of this? Do you think colleges and universities have a moral obligation to address problems at fraternities? Do you think the benefits outweigh the problems? What do you think needs to change, if anything? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on our Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Caitlin Flanagan, contributing editor to The Atlantic, about her recent piece on fraternities and their role on college campuses and the sometimes dark side and tragic events that happen there. You can join the conversation. Are you a fraternity member, or have you been? Or are you a college or university administrator? A parent, maybe. Would you want your son to join a fraternity? Call in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Caitlin, I want to dig into a little bit of the relationship between fraternities and colleges. Now, originally, it sounds like fraternities wanted to be independent from colleges, and the whole point was to assert that independence. And now there seems to be this sort of symbiotic relationship going on that may not serve either to the best effect. Can you tell us a little bit about how they're intertwined these days?
Well, the relationship certainly serves the fraternities very well. You know, if you think of every college and university in the country that has a fraternity system, has an office of Greek life. Oftentimes, if it's a big school, it's a very well-staffed office. If it's a public university, you and I are paying for that. So you have to remember that fraternities are largely subsidized by public dollars, in addition to their various aspects that are not have nonprofit status. So fraternities get a lot from their university connection. They get a lot of advertising and promotion. If you go onto any, you know, university that has a Greek system, you'll just click on and see a whole website there run by the university describing and promoting its different frats. The side of the equation that has less to gain from it, in a certain sense, is the university, because when there's bad behavior, it reflects badly on the university, and they may be named defendants in the lawsuit, although they often won't pay out on that. But in a sense, the university really needs the fraternities far more than the fraternities need the university. The fraternities provide a lot of fundraising. They provide a huge amount of social programming and make colleges more attractive to students when colleges are competing for student enrollment. And finally, the fraternities provide a tremendous amount of housing for American undergraduates. One out of every eight students in a residential college in America lives in Greek housing. So that's this huge amount of housing that colleges don't have to pay for, they don't have to build, insure, or maintain. So really, in many substantive ways, the fraternities have the upper hand in that relationship.
So what needs to change, then, in the way that colleges and fraternities interact?
You know, people often ask me that, and I one of the points of my essay is to say that it's quite naive to imagine that anything will really change. Remember that these young men have a constitutionally granted right to the freedom of association. It's an implied right from the freedom of assembly. So these young men have every right to belong to a private society that is conducted in privately owned house on privately held land. So the idea that the university has an ability to tell them they can't belong to that is inaccurate. Now, if it's a private college, they could potentially limit, say, that you can't belong to a fraternity. But again, private colleges are loath to infringe upon the constitutional rights of their students. So while fraternities are always changing and perhaps trying to improve their risk profile, I can't really envision, people will often, ever since I've written this, there's been all this writing and commentary about ways that could reform the system and the relationship. I think when you look at that constitutional nature of the rights of the young men who belong to it, it would be very difficult and perhaps not even, and I don't think it would be the right thing to do to infringe upon those rights, unless, again, it's a private college, in which case you can do whatever, you can legislate any kind of private behavior and you can violate any kind of right.
Let's get our callers in on this. We've got Zachary with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Zachary.
Hi.
Hi, what is your take on fraternities?
I just wanted to share, I was intrigued by the prompt because not only am I an alumni of a fraternity here in Wisconsin, but I recently received my master's in higher education and now am an administrator at a university in Wisconsin, and have definitely been able to see both sides of the coin, and kind of in my hindsight and in my education really seen some of the detrimental things that can happen in these organizations when they're not overseen by the administration and when kind of control from the university gets kind of loose. The organization I was in college was a local organization, and so unfortunately we didn't have a lot of the benefits that really draws people to Greek life, like the wide networking and budgetary and financial resources. But the things that I really took away from that experience were a lot of those transferable skills, though, just for my career and for my life, you know, those interpersonal skills and the ability to, like you said before, manage my own resources after having overseen a budget for a student organization like that. I think what was most helpful at our university was the fact that they really treated Greek life like any other student organization and expected certain programming on campus, certain involvement in the community, that really made us feel like we were more than our traditions and our secrets, but really got it.
Okay, Zachary, thank you so much for all your thoughts about your fraternity experience. And Caitlin, what about the case Zachary's making there?
Well, it's interesting when he talks about control by the university or the administration of the fraternities, and if there were more of that, the fraternity experience would be improved. What's interesting is that the universities and colleges do not want to exert more control over the fraternities for the following reason. The more that you get involved in monitoring the behavior on the frats, the more you establish your own duty of care and the more you become liable for something that goes wrong. So if the university gets deeply involved in saying, when you have a party, you have to do this, this, and this, and we need all this pre-information about your party, there's a little bit of it now, but if you really get into carefully monitoring the behavior to make them safer, well, then you've taken on the responsibility, the right to monitor. You take on the responsibility when something goes wrong. So this is one of the first things people will suggest is let's get administrations at college and universities more involved with the fraternities, and that'll improve the system. You get to the attorneys for the college and university, they'll say, nothing doing. We don't want to expose ourselves to that liability. So the university has perhaps a morally suspect but a legally very wise impetus to not get involved in monitoring that behavior. So that's another aspect of the tension where people will say, oh, this problem can be easily solved. Really can't be easily solved.
And, you know, we've been talking big picture on fraternities. I wonder if you could zoom in now and talk in particular about one of the stories that you tell in your piece. And this is a story about an incident at Wesleyan University. Could you tell us what happened there?
Well, this was a typical case that just shows how much power fraternities have in terms of their alumni. You know, Wesleyan University in Connecticut is a very elite, very small, it's really more of a private college than a private university. There's only, I think, fewer than 3,000 undergraduates, but they do offer graduate degrees. Anyways, one of their fraternities, Beta Theta Pi, had been very out of control for a very long time, lost its affiliation with the university, but Wesleyan kids were still going and partying there and getting into all kinds of dangerous situations. University, again, decides to do something it would come to regret, which is establish a duty of care by warning everybody. They sent an email to all the students and to all the students' parents saying, we're not affiliated with Beta Theta Pi. We don't want you to go there. It's not safe. We can't protect you if you're there. As strong a warning as you could imagine. And they were right to send it. It was a dangerous place. Well, immediately the 37 parents of the members went ballistic and wrote to the president, you've maligned our sons. They're about to enter the job market. You've called their moral character into question. And so when the new students arrived on campus that fall, nothing had changed at Beta Theta Pi, wasn't any safer, but the university decided we're not going to send that email out to the freshmen. Those parents went nuts the last time we did it. Well, it wasn't 2 months into the school year before a young freshman, 18 years old, wanders over there, gets violently raped at a party, and ended up filing a very well-considered lawsuit saying that her Title IX rights had been violated because she hadn't received that warning. So for universities, anytime you play fast or loose with the fraternities, it's really going to come to serious matters. So it's very, very hard for college administrations to know what the right thing to do is. If you warn students, you get in trouble with one set of constituents. If you don't warn students, you can expose them to serious risk. So that was a real case in point of how this whole dynamic between institution and fraternity really plays out.
And we'll have to leave it there. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Caitlin Flanagan, a contributing editor at The Atlantic.